This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
This is the third year for which the Center for Ethics in Science and Technology has focused on a book. This year, Siddhartha Mukherjee's Emperor of All Maladies. Our forums are for the public to hear about exciting new developments in science and technology, but this is not intended merely as an outreach program. We don't like to think of this as outreach. The purpose here is to do something more. We're seeking to identify and figure out how to solve the challenges that we will face in trying to adopt these new technologies or develop them. These are the ethical challenges. How do we act? We want to facilitate a community dialogue to make that possible, where scientists and members of the community can talk to each other. So part of this program includes time when you should be asking questions, putting out ideas that can become part of the conversation, so we as the scientific community can do better. For our 2013-2014 series, we've been privileged now to hear from leaders working on some of the most promising developments in cancer research. This evening, the sixth program in the series will be no exception. You'll hear more about the speaker and the program in a moment from Dr. Ivor Royston, who has been instrumental in identifying and inviting these outstanding speakers. But first, I want to acknowledge again the support for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society and invite Kathleen Seymour, the executive director of the society, to come to the podium, and she will then introduce Ivor. And let's thank both of them for their support for this series. Thank you.
Good evening. As you said, I am Kathleen Seymour, and I am the executive director of what is the San Diego and Hawaii chapter of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. I also want to add my thanks to the Center for Ethics in Science and Technology and the committee for organizing this truly amazing event tonight. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society is proud to be a sponsor this evening. I'd really like to offer my biggest thanks to those in the audience this evening who are supporters of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And I know that there are quite a few out there this evening. If you have ever made a contribution to our organization at any level over the past 10 years, the discovery that you are going to hear about from Dr. Carl June is something that you own personally. LLS has been funding Dr. June and will continue to do so for the next several years. Our total commitment to him and his colleagues will exceed $20 million. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society... Yes! The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society funds research across the continuum, from basic research through clinical trials, from bench to bedside. To date, we have invested almost $1 billion in research. I ask you to sit back and enjoy this wonderful chat. And with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Ivor Royston, who will kick us off. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Kathleen, for helping us with today's event. We really appreciate the support that the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society have provided us for today, and also all of you in the audience who are supporters of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Today, you're going to hear from Dr. June describe his exciting new approach to harnessing the immune system to treat cancer. And after that, Dr. Garth Powis, the new director of the Sanford Burnham Institute's Cancer Center, will sit down with Carl to discuss his work and take questions from the audience. And as this speaker series has tried in the past to deal with the social, ethical, and regulatory issues surrounding new technologies that are being used to treat cancer, I expect that we'll get into some of these with regard to this new type of immunotherapy that you will be hearing about. Each year, Science Magazine chooses the most important scientific breakthrough of the year, not just in medicine, but all of science. For 2013, the choice for the breakthrough science of the year was immunotherapy of cancer, and much of this was the work of Dr. June. Dr. June holds an endowed chair in immunotherapy at the University of Pennsylvania, where he is professor and the director of translational research at the Abramson Cancer Center. The idea of harnessing the immune system to fight cancer has been around for many decades, but only now, with the pioneering work of Dr. June, has substantial progress been made. He has received numerous awards and accolades, too numerous to recite. He's been the desired keynote speaker of many of the national and international cancer and hematology meetings. And so we are really, I'm really excited by the fact that he accepted our invitation to come here to La Jolla to address you guys. One final thing, there is also a local connection. The longest surviving adult and the first adult with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which was fatal, is a patient that went to Philadelphia to be treated by Dr. Carl Jones in his program. And this patient, the patient's parents, live here in the San Diego area, and they are in the audience today. His parents credit Dr. June and his team for saving the life of their son, who's in complete remission. I just want to close with a quote by the author of the upcoming cover story of the May 26th Forbes magazine issue. The title of the cover story is The Cure for Cancer. And in that story, you'll read about Dr. June's work, and there's a quote in there that caught my attention, and the quote by the author is that the developments at Penn, University of Pennsylvania, point tantalizingly to something that would rank among the great milestones in the history of mankind. Perhaps that's a grand statement, but We'll be able to decide that in the future, but it's really quite a quote. So anyway, we're going to start the program with a short video, and then we'll introduce Dr. June. So if we can dim the lights, we'll go ahead and show the video.
Take one.
Is it hard for you to say those words? We're trying to cure cancer.
That's a really good question. Why it's hard to say we want to cure cancer. We do. And I think sometimes it's hard actually to think that you might actually succeed.
Patients that we're treating on this clinical trial have absolutely no other options left for them. These are patients who are unfortunately destined to die of their disease and in a fairly short amount of time.
Emily Whitehead, 554.
So Emma is incredibly matter-of-fact about all of this stuff. This was a child who had had her leukemia come back twice. The parents were looking for a miracle.
What we've learned how to do is train the immune system to recognize and then kill tumor cells.
It's a procedure where we collect their T cells, and they are infected with a virus that will genetically change them so that they will now see and react against their leukemia cells.
And we actually use the HIV virus to do that.
So you're taking the HIV virus and infecting healthy cells with it to help kill cancer?
Yes. The virus has been engineered so that it can't cause disease anymore. But it still retains the ability to reprogram the immune system so that it will now attack cancer cells. We call those modified immune cells serial killer cells. Each infused cell can kill more than 1,000 different tumor cells.
But the reality is the dramatic responses of cancer to new treatments are very unusual. We need to make it clear when we talk to a family that it may not work. Emma was given her T-cell treatment, and within a few days, she was very sick. She had breathing difficulties, she had blood pressure difficulties. We knew that she could not have gotten any sicker without actually dying.
But then a remarkable thing happened. The T-cells were growing, they were starting to fight the cancer.
Within hours, Emma's fever disappeared.
It was like the calm after the storm. The clouds went away, and she woke up, and there was no leukemia. When that child survived, it was, of course, an amazing event.
Want to welcome to the stage, as they say, Dr. Carl June.
Well, I want to thank Ivor Royston for that really very generous introduction. I'm just a regular guy that happened to be in the right place at the right time. And so I'm going to talk about how we got to where Emma was treated, and then you know, some of the things where we can go in the future. And on the front of the slide, it mentions the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. I'll tell you, an issue is that we couldn't get funding from the National Cancer Institute to do that trial. You know, we're in a real problem, disarray right now in national funding of research. It was all done by philanthropy, and I, we received a lot of money over the last 15 years from Leukemia Society, and they've been the primary ones that developed this. There was no industry support available. And so we have ongoing support, as was mentioned, and a lot of people here have run in events and done things to raise money, and it's made a gigantic difference. And it's really important for new therapies coming forward now to have people involved in philanthropy like that. And so I'll describe some of what immunology 101, if you will, of what a CAR T-cell is and how we treated leukemia with it, and then what might be the next steps. And then with Dr. Garth Powis, we're going to have a discussion here in Q&A timing. So the idea of immunotherapy, you know, is not new. The ideas were over 100 years ago that the immune system might be able to control cancer. And but it evolved most certainly, you know, to kill viruses. So T cells, which are the cells we use, evolved to detect mutated cells because they've been infected with a virus. And the cancer idea is that maybe cancer is also a mutation. Maybe then a T cell could attack those in cancerous cells. And but the initial studies didn't work. And for a century, we've had no FDA-approved therapies that use T cells to treat cancer. And but we're now at a tipping point for several areas, and it's listed here. In 2011, the first drug was FDA approved to really unleash T cells to kill, and that was for metastatic melanoma, where drugs have never worked or never have been a licensed drug that has any effect in metastatic melanoma that's really repeatable. And then we've had an amazing breakthrough with so-called checkpoint therapy with the PD-1 family of molecules, and that now will extend it to things beyond melanoma, but actually to non-small cell lung cancer, which is NSCLC here on this slide, and kidney cancer, and others, I am sure. And then finally, you know, we've had over the last several years, the CAR T cells have come and been shown now to be very effective in several forms of leukemia and lymphoma. So that was, as Ivor Royston mentioned, recognized on the cover of Science magazine as T cells on the attack now. So T cells can not only control infections, but they can control cancers, and we need to learn how to use them. And this is coming forward now because of the major advances in basic science that allowed us to understand why the previous therapies failed. And so my background to this began actually in up in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I played on football teams, and I was recruited for Division I football. Believe it or not, at one point I could bench press 300 pounds. And then I lost this race. The person I was trying to tackle there became a pro athlete and played for 10 years on in professional sports, and I could never catch him. And I then applied, was going to go to Stanford University, but it was a year where they had drafts in 1971, and I was going to go to Vietnam. And so there, I went, instead of going to Stanford, I went to the United States Naval Academy and watched people continue to get stronger and stronger, and I couldn't. And I found out why. That was actually performance-enhancing drugs. And when I went to medical school, there was the actual textbooks of medicine said drugs didn't make you stronger. You know, they said steroids just made your muscles swell up and that it was water weight. And I knew that was not true because I had seen it in the fields. And I knew that when people took those things. They did get stronger. And this is then the first amazing statistical proof in another way, which is Barry Bonds. And it shows when he came into the major leagues, as a rookie, it took him 25 times on average to hit a home run. And then he became a seasoned and mature athlete. And you can see that for about 10 years, he averaged about 15 times at bat before he would hit a home run. And then he did this amazing thing where at age 40, he got better. And we now know in retrospect that was because of Balco, and he started drugs. And he took less than 10 times to hit a home run. So no one thought that that could happen, that a highly trained athlete, you could make the muscles better and neuromuscular coordination improve. So, you know, my motto for the lab for 15 years is, can we do that for the immune system? And attack then and turn a situation where the immune system usually fails, which it does usually in cancer, and then make it come out in a different way. So this is a field of what's called synthetic biology. And synthetic biology is familiar to many people here because of the advanced biotech, high-tech fields that are here. But it's in our case, we're talking about putting the immune system on steroids. And how can we do that? So we're not talking about the natural immune system, but we're talking about creating cells that didn't exist in nature, so not Darwinian evolution. And so for biomedical researchers, these can have a number of effects, such as what Craig Venter is doing here, to make artificial life or to make biofuels that can eat up and remediate oil spills, or the CAR T cells that I will show you, which I think will be the first thing to enter the practice of routine medicine where they're artificial synthetic biology cells. So the basic approach of what we do, it was shown somewhat in that movie, but basically the patient donates T cells, as they would in the Red Cross, and then those cells are manufactured in a laboratory with a process we developed over about 20 years. And I'll explain. When we said an HIV vector in that, or virus in that movie, it's called a lentivirus that was actually engineered here at Salk Institute by Inder Verma initially, and shown, instead of becoming a pathogen that destroys your immune system, to be making it into a tool that we can use to improve the immune system. So that's a major fundamental thing, to be able to take a virus that causes a disease and then you turn it into something that is useful. And so it genetically modifies our cells in a way we want that I'll describe. And then this process takes 10 days, and then they're given back to the patient in a very simple and anticlimactic blood transfusion, and they're white blood cells. So the issues about this process that are different than, say, chemotherapy or any other currently approved drugs are that it's customized for every patient. In a way, it's like a vaccine, but it's their own immune system. So it's an ultimate form of a personalized therapy. And then we had this major issue that it's been a market failure. There is no industry making, you know, personalized cells like this, because it's not something the pharmaceutical industry wants to do, where it has to start at the patient, go to a manufacturing plant, and then go back. They would rather make the same drug for everyone and then give it, you know, to the patients. And that's a standard pharma model. And then we had to build a T-cell culture system. And that's because T-cells, unlike red cells, there is no universal donor. So unless you have an identical twin, you yourself have to be the donor, and because your T-cells won't work in someone else. So very different than other kinds of blood cells that could be transfused pretty much at will between people with standard technology. So we had to learn how to grow the cells, and that took about 15 years. We found how T-cells grow in basic signaling studies, and then we made little beads in this micrograph here. The brown is iron sulfur, it's a ferrous sulfate that's in the center of these beads. It makes them paramagnetic, and they're about the size of a cell. They're 4.5 micron spheres, and they then activate the T cells in a way so that they start to grow. And then after 10 days, we remove the beads by passing them over magnetic field, and these are beads that are retained, so they're brown, and then those are the cells we infuse. They look kind of like white chocolate, and we give, in general, less than 10 billion cells. The whole body is 10 to the 12th, so 1,000 billion T cells, and we gave Emily 10 to the 7th, so much, much less than what was in her body. The thing is, they then replicate in the body, and the body then becomes a bioreactor and the cells grow. So unlike other drugs, these are self-replicating after they've been activated. And this cartoon shows a little bit more detail about what a T-cell is. So T-cells, each one of them has a receptor, the T-cell receptor, which is called the TCR for obvious reasons, T-cell receptor. And they're the same. There may be about 10,000 on one cell, and they all will target some virus usually. In this case, the most common virus is a herpes virus like Epstein-Barr virus that causes mononucleosis, for instance. And then what we do is use the HIV virus to introduce the CAR, and then it goes inside the cell, and then it inserts its genetic payload, which is our chimeric antigen receptor, and that's now permanently inside that T cell. So if the T cell ever divides the daughter cells, you'll now have two. The CAR then it comes out from the gene and is expressed on the surface of the T cell, making that T cell now bispecific. And so it has like a day job, maybe controlling flu through its T cell receptor, and then it has its CAR, which is its killer cell. It makes it a hunter cell specific for cancer. In this case, for a molecule on the leukemic cells that we want to kill, it's called CD19, and then it kills it. And that killing effect here, where through the CD19 CAR, is also triggers that CAR cell to proliferate. So there's a self-amplifying loop where the more tumor cells you have, the more the CAR cells divide until the cancer's gone. Then the fever goes away, which is what happened in Emily's case, and then the T cells stop dividing. So they divide as long as there's tumor around. So this shows in more detail the initial clinical trials we started. It was for patients with advanced chronic lymphocytic leukemia and who were adults. And they donated blood. They went through the T-cell activation, introducing the chimeric antigen receptor with the virus, modified virus. And then that process takes 10 days. And then we remove the beads on the magnetic system. Then they're frozen. And then the cells then are taken to the patient's bedside. They're thawed. And then when the last ice crystal is gone, they're just injected. And it takes 5 minutes. So that's the actual process, and it's patient-specific. The disease CLL is the most common chronic leukemia in the United States. It's about 15,000 cases. And in general, there is no cure except for a bone marrow transplant. And that would be fine, except for the average age of CLL is around 70 or 72. So many people at that age can't really undergo a bone marrow transplant. So there is not usually curative therapies. And this is the survival rate if you have gone through chemotherapy and then the leukemia comes back. It's not good. However, many people with CLL can live a long time and don't need therapy. But once they need therapy and then it comes back, then it's a serious problem. And those are the people we started to treat. The first patient was treated on July 31st in 2010. And it was described in the New York Times, and they made this cartoon describing the process I just described, so that, you know, we took his patient, the cells, used the HIV to modify the cells, insert the CAR, and then they became bispecific, and then will do two things. They'll kill any leukemic cell expressing that CD19 molecule, but they'll also kill any normal cells that express that molecule, because the cell can't tell the difference. The normal cells that do express CD19 are B cells. And B cells in your body are what normally makes antibodies. So the one long-term side effect we have is that the patient needs to get antibody replacement. And so that's done by every 3 months or so. They get an injection of antibodies, which are pooled serum that's made usually in companies like the Red Cross. So the first three patients that we treated then, we reported a year later. So that was sponsored by the Leukemia Society. We ran out of money at that point. Couldn't treat anyone for a year. So but the first three responses were so striking that we reported them. The patients all had between 3 and 7 pounds of tumor. So very, very advanced, incurable leukemia with the standard therapies available. They got a single infusion of the cells, and then we found that the cells divided about 10,000 times in the patient. So if we infused, as I mentioned, the number 10 to the 7th, that's 10 million, 10,000 times division would be 10 to the 11th. Cells are now in them. So that would mean, on average, if there's 10 to the 12th T cells, one out of every 10 cells in our body now is a leukemia-specific killer cell. And that's what we found. So then And so we reported that, and then we've said, as it was in that movie, that on average, each of the CAR T cells killed 1,000 tumor cells. And that means the cell itself, the T cell, or its progeny, the daughter cells, when they divide. And we have found that the remissions in those patients are durable. So the first patient treated, it was in the New York Times, was Bill Ludwig. He was a retired Marine who then became a prison warden. And there's quite a dramatic story about him, but he's normal and plays golf every day now, and has not required any further treatment other than the antibody replacement therapy. And, you know, antibodies are normally made by B cells. One reason we call these CAR cells chimeric antigen receptor cells is a chimera. You know, the Greek word chimera is a creature that's made out of two animals, mythologically. So our T cells are chimeras in that they are like a B cell, because they have an antibody in them, and they're also a T cell. So they're chimeric cells. And they continue to make antibody now, we now know, from the patient Bill Ludwig, now more than 3 years out. Emily was treated on April 16th, 2012, and she just had her two-year anniversary. She still has these chimeric antigen receptor T cells in her 2 years later. My team got the Philadelphia Award back in May of this year, of May 2013, a year ago. And the first six men that had had leukemia and had complete responses came. It was a surprise thing for me. I had not met them. And I mentioned Bill Ludwig. He was the one in the New York Times. This was a patient reported in the New England Journal of Medicine who had very late stage CLL as well. He's actually a PhD scientist. And Bill Ludwig mentioned in the New York Times and on his television interviews, it said what he did after he found out his leukemia was gone. He said he bought an RV and was going to go on retirement with his wife. Doug Olson went to Annapolis and bought a boat. So they both had life-changing experiences. It was quite interesting to watch. This gentleman here was a seventh patient we treated. He's a baseball coach from Los Angeles, Little League Baseball. We then, after, you know, because of the federal rules, we initially, and this is an ethical issue that we could discuss, we then started treating childhood leukemia, and Emily was the first patient we treated. And there are different designs of these CARs. I showed you sort of a stick figure before, but they're made of these antibody fragments, hinge and spacer domains, and signaling domains. And we're using what's called a second-generation CAR. We can even soup them up more. We call them then muscle CARs. So they get more and more potent, and we're just testing those in the clinic now. And the trial for kids we called PD CARs for the pediatric aspect of that. But Emily actually got the same kind of second-generation CAR as our adults have been getting. But we do have more potent CARs now in the laboratory that are just entering for treatment. But Emily, we had a spectacular course, as you saw. She looked very ill. The reports were reported at the hematology meetings in December. At that time, she'd been in remission about 7 months. And it was covered then in the New York Times, and she looked a lot better, as you can see. So that's from April, what she looked like, and in December. So what we learned out of that is you can learn a lot out of one patient. And, you know, the kids are a lot more photogenic and attract a lot more attention. That movie that, you know, Ross Kaufman's the director that did Born into Brothels, and he did that three-minute documentary you saw, that's been seen 250 million times. So she is educating the world about cancer immunotherapy now, and I think is a wonderful spokesperson. The first adult we treated with acute lymphocytic leukemia was Keith Eaton, and that was mentioned by Ivor. I knew of his doctors taking care of them, and they called me and said, could we treat him on an emergency basis? Because he had a form of leukemia that did not respond to chemotherapy. So this is what his bone marrow looked like in December of 2012. These nasty cells where the red arrows are leukemic cells, and he'd had very, very aggressive chemotherapy from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle, where I trained, and it didn't put him in remission. A month after we gave him the CARs, this is what his bone marrow looked like. It was in complete remission. And a normal bone marrow, you should see a lot of different kinds of cells. A leukemia bone marrow, you see a lot of cells that look the same. And so it's pretty easy to tell that you shouldn't see a lot of these cells. And you don't see them here. And he remains now in remission 15 months later and is back at work. So we reported at the here in San Diego in first week of April, that's the major meeting in the American Association of Cancer Research, and these are the results that were reported on the first 30 patients with acute lymphocytic leukemia. There were five adults, of which the first was Keith, and all five of those had complete remissions. And we have now treated, at that time, 25 children, all very late-stage leukemia, as you saw with Emily, and although Emily was the first. And this is what we showed, something that's quite striking, a 90% complete response rate. 27 out of 30 people have complete remissions, which is really unprecedented in a phase one cancer trial. And the six-month overall survival rate now is 78% in this group. So it's very, very promising. We didn't know initially if we got lucky, you know, over those first couple of patients. But now it's turned out to be reproducible, and it's been our results have been pretty much replicated now at the Memorial Sloan Cancer Center in New York and the Fred Hutchinson Center in Seattle. So it's spreading now beyond Philadelphia. And this is a review from the German Multicenter Acute Lymphocytic Lymphoma Group. And they looked at all the previous drugs that have been approved for acute lymphocytic leukemia. And you can see that, you know, the response rates were 20%, but no drug showed a survival benefit like the curve I just showed you. So they were very short duration. So what you can say now is that these trials with CD19 CARs are, in fact, you know, having unprecedented results compared to previous drugs for this usually very rapidly fatal leukemia. So this is what Emily looks like a week ago. That photo was just sent to me from her parents, but she is now, you know, at just past her two-year remission, and we're recruiting her to the University of Pennsylvania. And she actually wants to be a veterinarian. And so the most severe side effect is what oncologists call shake and bake. It's very, very high fevers. Emily had 3 days of 106 degrees. And it's more violent in children than in adults, we learned. This is an example of our seventh patient we treated, but he's called 09 here. But the fever curve there goes between 99 and 103. And these are the temperatures measured every 6 hours. So this is day 7, day 8, day 9, day 10. And he didn't have an infection. We did all kinds of cultures. This is caused by the T cells killing the B cell leukemia cells. And then we gave a drug that blocks a certain growth factor called interleukin-6. And you can see the fever immediately goes away. And that's what saved Emily's life as well. So she was treated with that. And then it's like a rheostat. I mean, it just goes away. So we now give patients routinely this after they've had fever for a few days. But we tell them ahead of time to expect to have fever. It's what's called an on-target effect. It's what we want. We want the tumor cells to go away. But your immune system, when it's making viruses go away, causes fever as well. And if you take away all the fever, it doesn't work as well. So we need to have some fever. It helps the immune system work. So we have to walk a tightrope there. Not too much fever, but without it, the patients don't go in remission. Okay, so this is where we're at as of now. We've treated, as of about a month ago, 62 patients, 32 of the adults with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and then 30 children and adults with acute lymphocytic leukemia with a very high response rate. And, you know, and the issue now is, how do you get it so that it's everywhere? I mean, there are no trials right here in San Diego. We've had patients referred. Here, they have to go across the country. So how can we get that done? And the answer is biotech and pharma. And where we're at right now, the medical care that you all receive is really three pillars. It's the pharmaceutical industry, who makes drugs and have done that for a very long time. And then it's the biotechnology industry, of which a lot of it started here, where recombinant proteins are made. And then it's devices like dialysis machines and bypass pumps and so on. And that's what we have. And the FDA regulates all those in very specific ways. What we need to get to is a fourth pillar, in addition, which is how do you deliver personalized cell therapies of the kind that I've just described. And that has to happen if what we're going to have is going to become a routine therapy. We now know it works, but what we don't have is the ability right now to make it. There's not enough availability to make it happen in every city. And I mentioned already one issue is it's patient-specific. It's not the standard pharma model, you know, where it's the same drug treats everyone. And can the manufacturing be done at local blood banks or will have to be done centrally at manufacturing centers? Right now, the FDA wants it done centrally to have high-level control because of the genetic modification of the cells. But in the long run, I think it will end up being more peripheralized. So we'll see as things roll out. I make an analogy to cars, and we wrote an editorial in Nature about this, that the cars that we have in Detroit are made initially by hand and by, the Henry Ford assembly line. One by one, mechanics and technicians put them together. But now cars are made by machines. So they're made by robots and automated. About 80% of a car is made that way, which is why we have a lot of unemployment in Detroit, unfortunately. You don't need human labor anymore. So our culture system that we made, I described, we add some beads to cells. We add special growth media to the cells. The beads are then removed, and the cells are frozen. Viruses added to introduce the car, et cetera. That right now is done by highly trained technicians and scientists, PhD scientists, that have years of training to do this. That, because it will be a labor shortage, it'll never be done in large scale that way. It needs to be done by machines and robots. So this is now an engineering problem, is what faces the field, so that this becomes widespread. And now, fortunately, that's being done. The academic centers are not very good at automating and developing these kinds of engineering solutions. It's best done in industry. And before, there was no effort being put into this. And so now it's occurring. There have been reviews on how to do this and how, the complexity of your process determines on how efficiently it can be automated. And I've taken that analogy of cars more. So if you have a standard car with not very many options, like a Volkswagen, those are very highly automated, and the cost per vehicle becomes a lot less. Now, if you have a Lamborghini, you're in trouble because you can't do that with a machines. Those are put together by hand because they're very highly customized and they cost a lot more, as you know. So we need to have robust cell culture processes that are capable of being automated. And that's partly now being done in this case by Novartis, who licensed the technology we developed, and they bought a large plant in Morris Plains, New Jersey, that will support the manufacturing of cars. And we're now in the process of transferring what we know and a process we've developed in a university setting so that they can do that in an industrial setting. So this is now it's optimistic that this can happen and become widespread in the future. And so this is the remaining really large scientific question, what I call the elephant in the room, which is, can this work in solid tumors that are a lot more common than leukemia? So I said there are 15,000 cases of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, per year or so in the U.S. There's more than 100,000 cases of lung cancer and, very colon and breast cancer are much, much more common. So until we have automated equipment, that can't be tackled. But we also don't know yet, will this technology be adaptable towards these kinds of cancers? There's hopeful data that it can be, but those trials are just beginning. I've listed here a number of other kinds of trials other than B-cell leukemia and lymphoma. And there's different targets. I mentioned for CD19, the target, the B-cell, there's about 100,000 of these a year in the United States of different kinds, from acute leukemias to chronic leukemias. And then there are other targets such as mesothelin, EGFR variant 3, and then targets for myeloma, neuroblastoma. Almost any cancer you can name now is being targeted in some lab across the United States now with CARs and preclinical models. So we're in an explosive time of growth in this field, and we'll see, I think, rapid advances. And I'll stop with that, and we'll begin having some questions. Thank you.
Okay, Dr. June, we heard about your football days and why you didn't go into football ultimately.
Yeah.
What made you become interested in immunotherapy, which was obviously much later in your career?
I trained in bone marrow transplantation. That when I started my fellowship, I got out of the Naval Academy, went to medical school, and then at that point,
I was in the Navy because I had gone to the Naval Academy and I had a long obligation, but they let me go on a medical, you know, when the war got over. So at that time, the Navy was very interested in radiation casualties because the Navy operates nuclear submarines. A lot of people here in San Diego area are familiar with that. And one way to treat radiation casualties is bone marrow transplantation, and that had just come out and been shown to work in the early 1980s. So I went to Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center to learn that. The Navy wanted to open a bone marrow transplant center for radiation casualties. And then, so there I saw leukemia being treated with bone marrow transplants. But I also saw what happened when the immune system got overactivated. So there were times with a bone marrow transplant, you can get something called graft versus host disease. And that's the incoming T cells from your new bone marrow donor can kill a patient, and they attack in general the liver, the skin, and your intestinal tract, and they can kill you in 3 weeks. It's an extraordinary thing. It's horrible to have to see, but it taught me the power of the immune system, and that's where I got interested in that.
Well, the other thing you mentioned in your presentation, and you went over it pretty quickly, was the history of immunotherapy. And I think most people recognize that it started almost over 100 years ago, and in Dr. Mukherjee's book, The Emperor of All Maladies, it actually refers to Cooley's toxin and how the immunotherapy started. And he's often known as the father of immunotherapy, I guess. So that would put you as the great-grandson of immunotherapy. Yeah. I'm not quite sure how the generations go. But could you just put in context what's happening now? Because immunotherapy has been around a long time. It's been pretty unsuccessful until recently. So I can see, and you mentioned why there's a difference, but why has it taken us so long to get to this point where we are now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, it made those disappointing results left the area underfunded because the pharmaceutical industry gave up because they did numerous trials. It didn't work. And rightfully so, people lost interest in it. However, as science advanced, we then learned where the shortcomings were. And one of those was that the initial models of cancer in mice, as you know, but were caused by transforming viruses. And so those are something the immune system actually handles very well, because a virus is what the immune system grew up and learned to kill. But so for about 30 years, everyone thought those mouse models were like human cancer. And it was only in about 1990 they realized that human tumors are really caused by mutations and not viral. About 10%, maybe 15% of human tumors are virally caused, of which the most common, you know, would be cervical cancer in the United States from HPV. And then across the world, it's liver and cancer and so on from hepatitis viruses. So those viruses are much easier to treat with the immune system than, for instance, a cancer caused by environmental things, such as sun that causes melanoma or smoking that may cause lung cancer. So the initial immunotherapy was all directed at a way to stimulate the immune system the way you would if it were caused by a virus. So then they learned that, and then what they didn't understand also was the complexity of the immune system. And it was not described until 1995 that there are both and understood there are suppressor cells that shut down the immune system and prevent you from getting autoimmune disease. And then there are these killer cells, which you need to get, and there has to be a balance between those. And the way the immune system was manipulated in many trials, it actually increased the suppressor cells, which allows the tumor to flourish, rather than enhancing the killer cells. So then, now we know at least which cells we want to activate. And so, like a lot of things, it was much more complex than we know. The cancers are much more complex than we're known, and so now that when all those things come together, it now makes it that we have better tools to solve those problems.
One thing that we know about cancer chemotherapy when you have small molecules or drugs is that the tumors are very adept to becoming resistant. We have some wonderful drugs now, but often resistance will develop within 6 months or so. Is there a chance that we'll see the same sort of evasion by the tumors that you're treating to this type of therapy? And if so, what can we do about it?
So, yes. And in a way, cancer is now looked at a lot like HIV is, where it's a rapidly mutating and it evolves in a swarm within a patient. You have one initiating cell, but by the time a patient is seen, if you have a kilogram of tumor, that's 10 of the 12 cells, there's many, many other mutations in there, and some cells are different than others, and that's one way to get resistance. And it's often said that unless you get resistant, you don't have a drug. You know, so you should, I mean, because the cancer will always find a way to come around it, almost always. So we've had two cases out of the first 25 ALL cases where, you know, we treated against CD19, and then they've later relapsed. In one case, it was 64 days after the patient went in remission, and then the leukemia came back, and it no longer had CD19. And we're studying the mechanism of that. One obvious solution is that we give combinations of CARs. We call them a fleet of CARs, so that you can't have escape. And that's just like we do in chemotherapy. You have combinations, so then it's, you know, you paint the tumor into a corner.
You obviously have somebody writing the CAR jokes into this as you go through. Dr. June, thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.